Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Eric Holdeman, Director of King County, Washington's Office of Emergency Management, who examines the Bush administration's systematic dismantling of the Federal Emergency Management Agency in the years before Hurricane Katrina destroyed much of the Gulf Coast. Daryl Malik Wiley, the Sierra Club's environmental justice staffer in Louisiana, who talks about the issues of race and poverty affecting the evacuation of New Orleans and the horrifying aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And Tyson Slocum, with Public Citizens Energy Program, who discusses skyrocketing U.S. gas prices in the wake of Hurricane Katrina and calls to enact temporary price controls. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Four top pro-Syrian Lebanese generals were charged with planning the February 14th murder of Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. The car bomb that killed Hariri and 20 other people led to massive protests in Beirut. International pressure led Syria to remove its troops from Lebanon after 29 years of occupation. Still, Syrian agents are suspect in a number of killings of anti-Syrian activists in recent months. The outrage following the killing of Hariri also paved the way for elections and a new parliamentary anti-Syrian majority. The four charged by United Nations prosecutor Detlev Melis are Major General Jamil al-Sayad, former head of General Security, Major General Ali Haj, former head of the National Police, Brigadier General Raymond Assar, former head of Military Intelligence, and Mustafa Hamdan, commander of the Republican Guard. The four generals had resigned in April due to pressure from opposition groups. They accused the generals of negligence in the murder investigation and with tampering with evidence. According to the Associated Press, UN investigators have accused Syria of refusing to turn over vital documents in their probe. Saad Hariri, son of the slain leader and head of a powerful bloc in parliament, told the Arabic Al Arabiya TV network of the investigation of the generals, "This is a beginning. The most important thing is to know who killed Rafik Hariri." After 16 years in power, Chicago Mayor Richard Daley's administration is mired in a major corruption probe. 21 people have been convicted of corruption in the city's truck leasing agency, and new charges were filed for falsifying scores on hiring tests for politically connected applicants. Four city workers have also been charged with aiding a Colombian heroin ring. The corruption probe is headed by U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald, the same prosecutor in charge of the Valerie Plame CIA leak probe. Several days after being questioned by the FBI, Daley publicly apologized for the scandal and promised to root out everyone involved. According to the news magazine In These Times, the scandal has tainted Daley's national reputation for rebuilding downtown Chicago, shaking up the city's public school system and the troubled public housing authority. In recent years, Daley tore down some of the city's infamous public housing projects like Cabrini Green and the Robert Taylor Homes. But little replacement housing was built for the former residents. As a result, critics say hundreds of families were left homeless. The scandal has also generated rumors that Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr., who represents much of the African-American South Side, may run against Daley in 2007. Jackson has recently called on Daley to clean up the stench in the scandal-ridden city Minority Set-Aside program. The biggest union drive among California farmworkers in 30 years is still in doubt. The United Farm Workers were 25 votes behind in a state-supervised election with over 2,200 votes cast. 171 disputed ballots will determine the outcome. The UFW has high hopes that worker outrage about the death of farmworkers from heatstroke in California's Central Valley this summer would generate a new pro-union surge 30 years after Cesar Chavez led his famous boycott against grape growers. Over the last year, farmworkers at Jamara Vineyards, one of the state's largest growers of table grapes, came to the UFW and the union launched a massive organizing campaign among 3,000 grape pickers. The family-owned Jamara Farm, with over 10,000 acres of grapes, ran a tough anti-union campaign among the largely undocumented workforce. Union organizers say the grower not only threatened workers' jobs but access to housing, food, and transportation. Tani Sibara, the UFW campaign manager, observed, "You've got to have a strong worker to put up with this stuff. They tell you, you vote for the union and you don't have a job. These people don't have much money." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
A full accounting of the devastation wrought by Hurricane Katrina may not be known for months, but many thousands of people have likely died, hundreds of thousands have been displaced, and entire cities, including New Orleans, have been effectively destroyed, requiring billions of dollars to rebuild. Outraged citizens around the country helplessly watched television images of children, the sick, and the elderly dying before their eyes, owing to the lack of a coordinated effort to supply survivors of the storm with water, food, and medical care. Much of the criticism on the failed response to the storm has centered on FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. FEMA Director Michael Brown, with no experience in disaster planning, was a Bush administration political appointee who had been fired from his previous job with the International Arabian Horse Association. Blame for the severity of the flooding in New Orleans was also directed at White House and congressional cuts in millions of dollars of funds requested by the Army Corps of Engineers over several years to rebuild and strengthen levees protecting New Orleans. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Eric Haldeman, director of King County, Washington's Office of Emergency Management, who wrote an August 30th editorial in the Washington Post titled, Destroying FEMA. Haldeman recounts how the agency was downgraded from a cabinet-level department and defunded, leading to what he believes was the systematic dismantling of FEMA, rendering it unable to adequately respond to the destruction of Hurricane Katrina.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency has had its ups and downs through the years since it was created in 1979. It came out of the Cold War and civil defense mentality. James Lee Witt was the first and only professional emergency manager to ever be the director of FEMA. He came out of Arkansas and followed then President Clinton to Washington, D.C. President Clinton made him and the agency a cabinet-level position, which puts him on an equal footing with the Department of Defense, the Secretary of State, because in this type of circumstances that we've just seen, FEMA has to totally coordinate across the federal government and with the impacted local areas. And James Lee Witt, being an emergency manager, understood what's called taking an all-hazards approach, that you don't concentrate on one single hazard. You need to consider everything as part of it. With the new administration came in, did not have a professional emergency manager as the director, and, you know, a pure political appointee. Then 9/11 happened. The Department of Homeland Security is created, and FEMA was absorbed into that Homeland Security Borg, using Star Trek language. And they lost their voice. They lost their seat at the cabinet, of course. They're submerged in this 180,000-person bureaucracy. FEMA's used to be, I don't know what they are today, there were about 2,000 people. And we had this total mind shift to only terrorism, 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 and that the billions of monies that have been spent on Homeland Security at the local level, and, of course, DOD and across the spectrum there, have all been terrorism-focused. And we lost the all-hazard capability. And I can tell you, folks at FEMA who knew what the right thing to do fought, I would call it, a rear-guard action on this, but they were overwhelmed, ignored, and many of the good ones left when they saw the handwriting on the wall. And those things happen, and when you ignore an all-hazard approach, you then risk the types of poor response from a demoralized agency and people who are, even today, right now, trying to do their very best to respond to this event.
Eric, there was underfunding for levee repair and strengthening that eventually was one of the key points that really allowed the water in to flood New Orleans.
There's a series of articles that were summarized by the Picayune Times. That's the New Orleans paper, main paper there. You know, you had Corps of Engineer officials being quoted over months. This isn't post facto, but leading up to this, we need this funding. Our funding has been redirected to other higher priority missions, and they even simply stated that, and they said, for Homeland Security and the war in Iraq. That's why I'm saying that all this could have hopefully been prevented with a very paltry amount of dollars compared to what this response and the terrible tragedy and human lives that we've seen played out these days.
Eric Holderman, as we close out here, I wonder, as you're in the business of preparing for disasters, natural disasters, terrorist attacks, any manner of emergency, what do you think should happen next in terms of accountability, congressional investigations, and maybe more importantly, how to rebuild the emergency response here in this country, including rebuilding FEMA?
We've been in some consultation already on this, and I was told that a bill was dropped in Congress to reestablish FEMA as an independent agency and a cabinet-level agency. I think that would be a significant first step to getting back to restoring the disaster response system to what it was pre-9/11 and this focus, single focus on terrorism. So that's number one. I think if you trust that the administration is going to fix this thing, and they were taking disaster preparedness away from FEMA in July. That's what put me over the top on writing the article to begin with. That's what motivated me and submitted the article, and then it was changed to include the hurricane. I think it needs congressional action. Inquiry hearings, whether it's a Katrina commission to investigate it, and then congressional action to fix the system. And we need to fix it quickly. You never know when that next natural disaster is coming, and we need to get back to where we once were.
That was Eric Holderman, director of King County, Washington's Office of Emergency Management. Read his August 30th editorial, Destroying FEMA, online at www.washingtonpost.com. In the wake of Hurricane Katrina's destruction of cities and towns along the Gulf Coast, some media outlets have pointed out that the poor and mostly African-American residents of New Orleans suffered disproportionately, with fewer resources to call upon to flee the approaching killer storm. Other outlets have focused attention on looting and violence, painting the whole black community of New Orleans, comprising almost 70% of the city's population, of being responsible for their own plight. The regions hit by the hurricane, including New Orleans, are made up of some of the poorest communities in the U.S. People living in the worst-hit areas of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama had incomes $10,000 below the national average, owned fewer cars, and had significantly less health insurance coverage than other Americans. Daryl Malik Wiley is the Sierra Club's environmental justice staffer in Louisiana. He's lived in New Orleans for 20 years and worked with the city's poor and minority residents to oppose the concentration of pollution-generating industries in their neighborhoods. After being evacuated to Texas, he spoke with Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus about the issues of race and poverty affecting problems with evacuation and the task ahead of rebuilding New Orleans.
We see the very few folks that are very upset and have started looting, but that's the media clip that gets repeated time after time on CNN and Fox and, you know, other media networks. It seems like that they're making criminals out of everybody in New Orleans if they're African-American, when that's not the fact. You have to understand that New Orleans is one of the poorest cities in America. 30% of the folks are below the poverty level. And this storm hit at the end of the month when a lot of people's welfare checks, support had not reached them. They've gone to their savings, and they could not physically pay for gas to get out of town if they had a car that was able to get out of town. So I think that whole issue is being portrayed as that's the way they want to act.
What do you think about officials describing those trapped in the city as those who chose not to leave?
I have been part of the LEPC, Local Emergency Planning Committee, in New Orleans in the past, and have know the emergency directors, and they just said, from their point of view, they didn't think that they could evacuate everybody that needed to be evacuated that did not have transportation. And this is stuff they told me years ago. They just didn't have the financial resources or the physical buses to get everybody out.
The wetlands around the city have been all but destroyed, which increased the impact of the hurricane. Do you see that destruction connected to environmental racism in any way?
The wetland destruction in Louisiana is not a new thing. It started in the 1950s when they started to do oil and gas exploration in water and offshore in Louisiana. And the energy companies built a whole series of canals cutting across our coastal wetlands and destroyed millions of acres of wetlands. Wetlands have been a sacrifice zone for America's energy needs. Our scientists have said for every mile of healthy wetlands buffer, you get a 1 to 2 foot reduction in storm surge. Rebuilding the wetlands in Louisiana has been one of the premier environmental concerns and an environmental justice concern also, because a number of the folks who make living off of fisheries in Louisiana are Native American, Vietnamese American, Cajun American. So there's a whole range of folks who make their living off of the sea, and the wetlands are the nursery ground for all the different fish and shrimp and oysters.
Some federal officials called last week for just abandoning the city. What do you think of that?
New Orleans is a unique city in that it is below sea level. That's something we all lived with. But it's also a culturally rich and architecturally rich city, in all the buildings built historically in the neighborhoods where a lot of the photos are being shot, especially in the Ninth Ward. They're buildings built in the late 1880s, early 1900s. Beautiful buildings architecturally originally, and then have fallen on disrepair because people just don't have money to keep things up. So it's a mix of architectural styles and designs that is a cultural heritage for America. And to hear statements that we should just bulldoze everything and turn out the lights is just, you know, astounding to me. What we in the Sierra Club are talking about and trying to come up with is a new vision for New Orleans, a new vision for the Gulf of Mexico. Since we have so much destruction, we need to think about how we can take that 30% of New Orleans population that doesn't have a job and put them to work rebuilding their community, not bringing in contractors from Brown and Root or wherever, the big Republican contractors that make the millions and billions, but put the citizens of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast to work and rebuilding their community, and also rethinking what it means to rebuild our community, to make it more transit friendly, to make it more education friendly, to make it more environmental friendly and ecological friendly. We should make New Orleans the premier sustainable community in the world. We have this opportunity. We have almost a clean slate. At the same time, keeping the cultural and historical elements alive and well in New Orleans.
Do you think the city could still be rebuilt below sea level?
I think we could rebuild the city of New Orleans where it's at. It's just an engineering issue. The levees, we're talking about breaches in just a couple places. So I think it is technically able to rebuild, and I think it's morally we need to rebuild New Orleans. And we need to rebuild that cultural history of New Orleans. It's a city for New Orleans, is a city of the world. And I don't think we can, as a country, can just let that go away.
That was Darrell Malik Wiley, the Sierra Club's environmental justice staffer in Louisiana. For more information, call area code 225-925-8650 or visit the group's website at www.sierraclub.org.
I had it, but it's all gone now.
Not long after news of the destructive force of Hurricane Katrina spread across the U.S., so too did skyrocketing gas prices. Many Americans saw prices climb well over $3 a gallon. While big oil companies tied the steep price hikes to the hurricane's effect on reducing oil production and refining in the Gulf states, some observers charged these corporations with price gouging and disaster profiteering. A Washington Post ABC News poll conducted on September 2nd found that 72% of respondents believe that oil companies and gas suppliers have taken advantage of the storm emergency by raising prices, while 80% say that the federal government has mishandled the rising price of oil and gas. President Bush has thus far only responded by ordering the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to waive national standards for clean gasoline blends. But Hawaii, with some of the highest gas prices in the nation, took action by placing controls on the price of gasoline sold in that state effective September 1st. Public Citizen has joined other consumer groups in calling for the enactment of temporary adjustable price controls at the federal level to prevent speculation and price gouging on gasoline and home heating oil. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Tyson Slocum, research director with Public Citizen's Energy Program. He explains how he believes big oil has gouged the public and why his group advocates price controls.
Well, first of all, it's important for folks to remember that oil and gas prices were well on their way to approaching record highs long before Hurricane Katrina. Hurricane Katrina merely sparked a more recent run-up in prices. And so as a result, it's clear that there is a direct correlation between the record profits being enjoyed by oil companies and the record prices being paid by consumers. Remember that America's largest oil companies are enjoying some of the largest profits, not only in the history of the oil industry, but in the history of any corporation in the United States. ExxonMobil alone has enjoyed profits of $89 billion since George Bush became president. So these oil companies are not only profiting off of high gas prices, but off of high crude oil prices, because they are monopolies. We've allowed so many recent mergers in the oil industry where former competitors like Exxon and Mobil, say, or Chevron and Texaco have merged into a single company that has not only oil production facilities in the United States, but around the world. ExxonMobil produces oil in the Middle East, in Africa, in Asia, in South America. They own oil refineries where crude oil is turned into gasoline. They even own branded retail gas stations on your street corner. As a result, we need to think more of this corporate oil cartel rather than the nationalistic OPEC oil cartel.
Tyson Slocum, the big oil companies' news reports talk about a disruption both in the supply of crude oil out of the Gulf of Mexico and the refining capacity in the Gulf states, Mississippi and Louisiana. And does that not justify some price increase because of a scarcer commodity?
Well, first of all, there's no question that Katrina severely disrupted some operations of the U.S. oil industry. For example, the Gulf of Mexico provides about 28.5% of all the U.S. oil production. The Gulf of Mexico is one of the largest oil-producing fields in the world. It alone provides about 2% of global oil supply. But the United States has something called the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. That is almost 800 million barrels of oil that are stored in Texas and other parts of the country that the president can order released when there is any disruption in oil supply, either from disruptions in oil production or from oil imports. So although some of the oil-producing capabilities of the Gulf of Mexico were knocked out, the oil companies knew that the United States would be able to instantaneously match whatever oil supplies were lost. And the Strategic Petroleum Reserve can last us months, which is far longer than it will take for those disrupted oil platforms in the Gulf of Mexico to come back online. So there was zero justification for any price run-up, because crude oil supplies were never threatened because of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Now, there's a second component here, and that is the oil refineries. And there, it is clear where the production of refined products like gasoline was indeed disrupted. And so a short run-up in prices because of constrained supplies was somewhat justified. But remember, immediately upon word of this disruption, the international group, the International Energy Agency, announced the release of 30 million barrels of refined products like jet fuel and motor gasoline would be released to the U.S. market. So again, the United States was not in danger of having shortages of refined products.
Tell us a little bit about Public Citizen's call for price controls in the wake of Hurricane Katrina.
First of all, price controls are not a solution to every problem, but they are a good short-term tool when you have dysfunctional markets. For example, during the California electricity crisis of 2000 and 2001, you had a dysfunctional market. You had a handful of companies led by Enron that were literally manipulating that market. They were charging extremely high prices. They were arbitrarily shutting down power plants to create false shortages. And the only thing that ended the California energy crisis was when the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission stepped in June of 2001 and enacted price controls. Those price controls were a remedy to a dysfunctional, uncompetitive market. And I think there's a lot of similarities in today's oil and gas markets to the California energy market of 2001. And we think that enacting temporary price controls where the prices charged to consumers will be directly tied to the costs will immediately reduce prices until we can get longer-term fixes to this dysfunctional market. And I think that's going to come from reducing the size and the scope of these large oil companies. And remember, it's not just Public Citizen that has made these allegations of market manipulation on the part of these oil companies. The federal government has come to that conclusion. In March of 2001, the United States Federal Trade Commission enacted an investigation of high gas prices back then, and the United States Federal Trade Commission concluded that oil companies were intentionally withholding supplies of gasoline from the market in order to drive prices up. And in fact, they quoted one unnamed oil company executive who said that he would rather produce less gasoline and earn a higher profit margin on each gallon sold than flood the market with more gasoline and therefore earn a lower profit margin on each gallon sold. So that's exactly what the oil industry has been doing. They have been intentionally keeping supplies tight in order to justify increasing prices.
That was Tyson Slocum of Public Citizen's Energy Program. Contact Public Citizen at area code 202-588-1000 or visit their website at www.citizen.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.